Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 11th of July, 2002. Today's session is entitled How to Respond to Religious Nationalism and Conflict Resulting from the 9/11 Tragedy. This session is hosted by Joe Bach and is session BOJ 2002-04. Let's listen in.
This is the fourth class of how to respond to religious nationalism and conflict following the 9/11 tragedy. I'm Joe Bach, your teacher slash facilitator for today. And I know that there are some people here, quite a few of you, who have been at previous classes. Is there anybody here who hasn't been at one of the earlier ones? Okay, so we have some of you. We'll try to provide somewhat of a summary, and for those of you who have been in the other classes, bear with me. I hope it's helpful to have at least some reinforcement of what you've already heard. I wanted to start out today, I was supposed to say roll the tape. So they know, okay. I wanted to start out today by summarizing something in a little bit of a different way than what we have in the past. And that is to say that we are, in understanding how this type of tension and violence erupts in different places, there seem to be three key parts to that. And this might help in summarizing some of the earlier class materials that we've had. But first of all, we talked about the Balkans and how in many instances, evidence of different ethnic or religious group cooperation, that physical evidence was actually destroyed by people who were trying to heighten the tension between the groups. So the positive, or the thing to remember there is that there is, in a sense, a reinvention of history or a covering up of history, however you want to put that. As we talked about it, there were two researchers at University of Chicago, a husband and wife team, Rudolph and Rudolph, who have done some incredible work in documenting this type of changing the evidence or the historical artifacts, as it were, over time. So number one, let's call that hiding cooperation or eliminating evidence of cooperation. Number two, exploit opportunities for division. Okay? And remember, we had talked about how some analysts are starting to make the distinction between there being a grievance between two different groups, and there, and that's a legitimate thing to be, you know, concerned about. There may be injustice, structural injustice, or whatever you want to call it. On the other hand, there are some people, oftentimes, that are able to benefit from unstable or even violent relations. So on the one hand, you want to look at grievance. On the other hand, you want to look at greed. And it's important to make that distinction. Oftentimes, it's not possible for, you know, political slash civic leaders or people with influence to really exploit a situation unless there are some, you know, legitimate conditions for concern. And the third, and this is something that has been documented repeatedly. I think I mentioned to you the writings, especially of, since we're in Washington, I'll tout Paul Brass, a professor at University of Washington, who wrote Theft of an Idol and has devoted his life to really documenting how in the South Asian context, they call it communal conflict. We're calling it religious nationalism and bigotry, but it's a similar type of thing. Paul Brass has documented how he calls them conflict entrepreneurs, and I've called them violence engineers based on my research in Gujarat, the state of Gujarat in India, where there are literally professionals who will go out and engineer a riot. you can pay them to do it, not always monetarily. So those are some things to keep in mind as it relates to how is it that groups that, you know, for years, this is the thing that's so startling, groups that for years, like in the Balkans, I mean, think of it, these people were neighbors. They probably had, you know, their neighbors' children come over and have birthday cake with their sons and daughters. And then once things unfolded and the whole mindset changed, what they call in the Fundamentalism Project as diagnostic frames, ways of looking at reality in a different way, placing new diagnostic frames in these people's minds. Once that has happened, you know, these families where they were closely in contact with each other, you know, send them across the street to borrow a cup of sugar kind of thing, end up, you know, on different sides in a conflict. It's an unbelievable thing. And it's like what I told you the first day, those of you who were here, that's what startled me enough to really want to really look at this in depth. I was walking through a slum in Ahmedabad, India, with a Jesuit priest who was running an organization called the St. Xavier Social Services Society. I know that's a mouthful. And it had started with doing relief projects because there's a river in Ahmedabad that floods. And they were helping the people, you know, with food, clothing, and that sort of thing after the floods. A lot of these people that live, especially in the slums, you know, they don't have anything. It's you know, a tent or whatever that they live in, and the floods are devastating to them. Anyway, they kept encountering communal violence, namely Hindu-Muslim violence. And what they had done is they had done a number of social service projects where they deliberately tried to cultivate interfaith goodwill. They called it interfaith harmony, a nice word. And so they would do a health project, and in the context of a health project, they would bring together Hindus and Muslim nurses and train them in traditional birth techniques or whatever, and they would talk at an appropriate time about how, you know, it's important for the two different faiths to be able to get along together, and they might send Hindus into a Muslim slum and Muslims into a Hindu slum and talk about that a little bit, you know, kind of a teaching moment. They did that. So they integrated in their traditional relief and development programs a deliberate attempt to build interfaith harmony. And then they also did some other programs in kind of a, and I want to start sharing some of these terms for you because tomorrow we're going to be really getting into this in depth. That was a promotive activity, okay? They called that a promotive activity, promoting interfaith goodwill, okay? They also had another type of activity that I distinguish from that called preventive activities, which are deliberately, in a very open way, trying to encourage people to understand in their minds the importance of interfaith harmony. And so they sponsored an essay contest. They had children submitting essays. They had a coloring contest for little children on the interfaith harmony theme. They commissioned a song. And I've got the transliteration of the song with me in this book. They put that song on a sack that they gave out. They had they call it a People's Festival every year, and the song was on that, the Interfaith Harmony song. And during that People's Festival, they got that song put in the newspaper. And so those were preventive activities. And then the third category was something they called promotive activities. I'm sorry, preventive activities are when you're explicit about it. Promotive are when you're not explicit about it. And then finally, preemptive are when you're trying to prevent violence when it seems to be imminent. And in order to do that, they placed an infrastructure in the slums that they were working in, peace committees. And these peace committees would do things like respond to a rumor, often concocted, that was designed to pit one group against the other. So they would literally, you know, some of these violence engineers would, you know, they would use brochures, you know, kind of like in, you know, political campaigns here, you'd use brochures. So they use these brochures and they hire little kids and oftentimes women to pass these brochures out. And these brochures are a rumor like, okay, there was a rape in the nearby city, we hear that the Muslims are arming themselves to come over and slaughter us tonight. You know, outlandish, bizarre things. And there may have been some truth to the fact, and this is what Paul Brass really points out in his book, there may have been some truth to the fact that there were actually a woman had been raped, but what they were doing is that they were exploiting that as an opportunity to make it a much larger issue than what it really had been. I mean, certainly it was horrible and everything else, but they were turning it into a huge issue. So these preemptive tactics were ones where people would try to counteract aggression before it turned into violence. So they set up these peace committees, and they would counteract the rumors or the brochures. And when I was walking through the slum with this Jesuit priest, he was telling me all about this, and we were walking through the slum, and he said, This is where there was a horrible riot. He said, we were devastated. We had worked for years, systematically, trying to build interfaith harmony, and it didn't work. And what we're trying to do in this sequence of classes is figure out what does work and how it applies to our context here in the United States. And so, in summary, remember, promotive, you don't say that you're doing it, you just do it. Preventive, you do say you're doing it, you're building your faith harmony. Preemptive, you're trying to prevent imminent physical aggression, namely violence. Okay? Now, what we're going to, and I'll give you a little bit of a preview for tomorrow as it relates to that, because I don't want you to lose those terms. We're going to be using this tomorrow. I've had some very faithful participants in the class, and I know that they're leaving tomorrow. I want to make sure you see this before you go. Anyway, people who have experienced promotive and preventive activities. I mean, this is the guts of the structure of the thing, okay? It's the same everywhere. It's a social phenomenon. It's the same in the United States as it is in South Asia, in the Middle East, etc. Now, those of you who have done software programming, this is a flow chart. It's a flow chart for a system dynamics computer simulation model that I've written. Okay? These are rates. These are considered levels. They're accumulations. Rate, accumulation, rate. This is inflow. This is outflow. Okay? So you're implementing programs, okay? And you're going in, you're investing in promotive and preventive activities. Right? People are experiencing those. So you've got people, you know, in your community that are understanding in their minds the importance of interfaith harmony. Okay? There's usually a delay in how they have an ability to get their family members and everybody else to appreciate that. And there may even, I mean, you can even look in some of the educational literature, I don't know if any of you have ever read Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, but he argues that unless you do, unless you go through three things, you really haven't changed people's critical consciousness at all. There has to be awareness, reflection, and action. Unless you've done those three things, you haven't had transformation. So there's a delay there because it is going to take time for people to become aware, to reflect, and then to act. Okay, so let's just assume that that's a number of weeks, okay? So by the time you've done this, you've invested in this, the people have experienced that there's a delay, and then people feel interfaith goodwill. And then you get what we're talking about, violence engineering or conflict entrepreneurs who rapidly, you're investing in preemptive activities over here, but you've got conflict entrepreneurs or violence engineers depleting this accumulation of goodwill rapidly. Hours, I mean, the dimension here is hours, the dimension here is weeks. Okay? So the question is if, you know, what can you do? I mean, the fundamental challenge, just like I was talking about, you know, the Serbs, Orthodox, Croats, Orthodox, you could say Muslims, Christians on college campuses in the United States. Great. Ethno-religious goodwill. Religious goodwill, okay? Great. 9/11 happens, all of a sudden you start hearing certain things on the radio, you start getting certain literature in the mail, you start hearing things from your church pulpit. Depletion. It's gone. All this investment, all this effort, gone. So the question really is, how to more effectively affect this to prevent the outflow, because you know that in certain circumstances, this is going to be incredibly potent in its depletion. That's the basic structure of it. Yes?
I'm curious about who the people are that are implementing the programming, and whether that those people are perceived as outsiders in the work you've done, or whether they're perceived as members of the community, and how that affects the dynamics of the situation.
Well, I think that sometimes, at least in India, the operatives are from outside. In fact, the kind of the thugs that get the violence going, they're often from the outside. But usually the leaders who are at the head of it, the figureheads, are within that community. They've got certain respect, authority, credibility within that community.
Well,
it's a good question.
About the people implementing the goodwill, the promoting and preventing.
Well, just because your original example was Christians, right. And I don't know whether they were indigenous or whether that was missionary situation.
Right.
Or
no, they were indigenous, and they had Muslims, Hindus, Jains, you know, et cetera, on their staff. So they were
already integrated.
They were
right.
Part of the community.
They were of the community, yeah. And then they worked closely with the slum residents themselves, you know. So it was indigenous, yes.
The other thing that seems missing from this is, you know, is the sort of deeper analysis of what in what interest and whose interest is the violence.
Right, it goes back to the greed question.
And,
right.
And you're just, because you're giving the generic model.
The generic, right.
But there is in that system, there is some stake.
Right, I mean, you could add that into, you know, kind of a,
right.
Exactly, and that would feed into this actually taking place. And then certain, what I found was there are certain times and certain places where this is going to happen. For instance, it may be here that it would be more likely during certain parades, particularly if they're religious in nature. I know that certainly in India, it's when there are holy days, there are large crowds of people, and there's been something that they can use as bait to blow out of proportion, to bring violence about. Well, what would be an example of somebody having something to gain out of violence in this country?
Political power.
Political power. What's that?
Arms makers. Defense people. Defense.
Okay. I guess there would be an advantage there. Other?
Media success.
Media success.
Radio talk shows,
right.
Programs.
Right.
Sell.
They know that people like to hear it.
Well, an unscrupulous real estate developer who wants a tract of land.
Right. Well, that happens in India. You think that happens here?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Well, I one of the things that I found really interesting in some of the research that I did was that this work of this group in India, it tended to be pretty successful when the issues were secular in nature. It tended not to be successful, with very few exceptions, when there were religious overtones involved, religious symbols being used on a holy day, lots of people. And I've since learned about something called the theory of moral violation, and I want to share with you what that is. This is something that's been developed by Clark McCulley, a social psychologist. And the theory of moral violation is as follows. Violence between groups of differing faith identities will tend to be more acute when one group is made to feel that the actions of those of the other group were a moral affront rather than being harmful in some other way. I mean, not only did they do something to harm us, but they deserve to be taught a lesson. You see what I mean? I mean, it takes it to a different level of emotional potency. So that's why when you have people that are, you know, wrapping themselves in the flag, pulling out a holy book, jumping on the radio, inciting violence, you've got problems on your hands. And you've got to be ready to deal with that. And what I'd like to do today is ask for, as you saw on the bulletin board, I'd like to do a small role play today because I think it would be helpful for us to really try to do a little bit of skill building. And I've got four different parts outlined. And what I'd like to do is hear from you how you'd like to work it. But I think what might be best is to break up into four groups and let people try to work out their own scripts as to what they want to say, and then we'll start an interaction between the four different groups. And let's go back to what the four groups are. Remember, throughout the week, we've been using this diagram, and we've emphasized how it's important that you deal with a co-religionist. Okay? You need to deal with someone of your own faith tradition, right? And also, the important thing is that you have an ability to have some sort of communication with those from other faith traditions, because aggression is in the eye of the beholder. And if let's say that a Muslim group is saying something that is offensive to a Jewish group, then someone from the Jewish group ought to be able to contact someone in the Muslim group and say, do you realize how offensive this is to us? And can you go ahead and try to talk with the people who are extremists within your faith tradition and try to get this straight? So we talked yesterday about how we're really missing the civic side of this. This is the religious side. What you need is a totally additional overlay where you would have a civic side, so that you would have a politician and you would also have another civic leader who would have some influence with that politician, assuming that the politician is the one who's really inciting the violence or the aggression. Because remember, we talked about how oftentimes religious leaders who might be, say, fundamentalist in nature might be giving ammunition to a politician to use, not always knowing that they're doing that, sometimes very much knowing that they're doing that. And the issue is working with that religious leader. We talked about different strategies of doing that, gatekeeping and nudging, or theological dueling. But somehow you've also got to deal with that political leader. So the role play today has four different groups, or actually four different people. And what I want to do is break people up into groups of four. I want you to work on what your script is going to be. And I'm going to walk to each around to each group. And then I want you to designate one person in each group to be the spokesperson. And then we're going to have the interaction and try to see how people can persuade those of the other in the direction away from conflict. Okay? Now, does this... Tonight we have with us a distinguished city councilman, Stan, a city councilman for the city of Tranquility. We also have with us the head of our Chamber of Commerce of the city of Tranquility, Gary. We have, to my right, Reverend Falwell, with the Committee in Defense of Christian America. And we have Lauren, a Lutheran pastor who is the head of a peace committee in the city of Tranquility, an interfaith peace committee. So let's start it out here. Stan, we'd like to hear a little bit more about this city council resolution that you've put forward.
Well, as I understand it, there's been an attempt on the part of a group to site and get permitting for a mosque in our fine community. And, of course, we need to recognize that here in Tranquility, and certainly in our city council, we have a belief in complete openness and acceptance of all religious faiths. We believe that Tranquility is known throughout the region as being open to people of all persuasions. We have, however, a few concerns that we need to bring before the people, particularly in the area of this particular suggested sighting of a mosque in our community. In particular, we need now not to say no to anybody at this point, but there are some concerns that would cause us to say at least that we need to look at this carefully, to examine the implications of such a new sighting of a mosque in our community, and we'd like to study this and put out a task force to study the wisdom of this particular development at this time.
So you want to form a task force to delay the granting of this permit to construct the mosque in the city of Tranquility?
Well, delay, I don't think anybody wants to be talking about delay. We're talking about being careful, as this community is known. There are a number of concerns. I don't know if you wanted me to spend a few moments listing some of the concerns that I'm sure that most people in this community can feel are important right now, or do you want me to yield to some?
Well, let's yield to Reverend Falwell over here. We'd like to hear your views on the city of Tranquility and its openness to people of all religious traditions.
Well, we already have a number of places that people can worship. They're welcome to come to all of our places, and we have enough right now. We have enough Christian. People should either be Christian or nothing else, and so they can all come to our church then. Christian nation. This nation has been built on Christianity, and that's the way we should keep it. That's why it's a great nation. That's why it's number one in the world.
I'd like to hear from our Lutheran pastor on that. What were you thinking about that, Lauren?
Reverend Falwell, is that an invitation?
Of course it is.
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that. And I think our invitation to others is very important. And I would like to remind you of something, though, that in our nation, we never know
who...
That's one of the founding factors of our nation, is that power that individuals and groups need to be protected from one another. I would like to see and know that your group and that your faction is also protected. We never know who could gain power, and it is very important for us to have an open and inclusive kind of nation. And I absolutely support your church. I think you have a position that's very important. And at the same time, we can't let that go too far so as to exclude others. And I'm personally thinking, frankly, I've looked at the Muslim community. I think they're incredible contributors to this community. Wouldn't you agree?
I certainly do.
Gary, our Chamber of Commerce.
Well, I really appreciate your concern for openness and the desire to maintain this town of tranquility for the wonderful living environment that it is. And I would imagine that with your interest in that concern for all of the members, that you really be concerned about equity amongst the different parts and portions of this community. And it's kind of peculiar to me that our permit process, which this mosque has gone through and has been examined carefully in the same way the churches has managed to meet all the concerns. And so I'm wondering about the specific list of concerns that you indicated, and the issue of the task force being something that is extra and has not been required of other churches. I'm just wondering how you can help us understand the special need that would be equitable.
I think there are two concerns. One is the reality of our city and where we are now in our infrastructure. We already have at least 27 different church campuses or religious campuses untaxed on our tax rolls now. We're now talking about taking up large part of a commercial downtown district, which will take it off the tax rolls. The water system, according to our city engineer, is already overtaxed. We're now going to have to develop a new infrastructure just for this siting for a facility that will produce absolutely no taxes into our already overstressed city budget. That's one type of concern we have. The other is just the human concern. There have been news reports of at least 113 incidents of violence against Muslim facilities in our state in the last 6 months. That's according to the Tranquility Journal. We believe in tolerance, and I think that the majority of our good citizens here in Tranquility believe in religious tolerance, but reality is we may be creating a magnet right now for further violence, a risk for our children. We may be citing something in our community since September 11th and the horrible tragic events of those days that bring upon our community something we really don't want to have happen. I think we need, as a community, to go slow on this and study it carefully before we make these kinds of major changes that are likely to affect the children and the good people of our community.
And Reverend Falwell, do you agree that these decisions should be made on things as secular as say whether it's going to bring in tax revenue or what it's going to cost the city, or are there other reasons why you think that this mosque?
Well, I think those factors are important, and I agree with him that we should go slow. And while we're going slow, these people are all invited to our church, certainly our church. And they still have jobs because they're working in the factory pulling turkey cuts. And that's a fact in our community. And so they have, it's not like these people have nothing. But they're welcome to come to our churches. In the meantime, we can go slow, as he says, because it is going to take another property off the tax roll. No question about it.
And so, Pastor Lauren, do you feel like in order to be a good American that everyone needs to be a Christian? Is that your perspective?
Well, I think clearly the U.S. Constitution certainly wouldn't say that. And I would like to add in addition to the Honorable City Councilman Stan that the day that Americans just go slow and do nothing but not take risks, we've abandoned we've abandoned our calling as Americans. I think we need to take risks. We've always extended and opened doors to others, and this is no different. Now is the time to step forward and to step up. I'm calling on you, Stan, right now to lead your troops forward. Let's have courage. I'm calling on you right now. And I would like to extend a handshake. Let's do it, Stan. What do you say?
I appreciate the fervor with which we both agree tranquility needs to be taken into the future with tolerance and religious understanding. We also need to recognize the law of unintended consequences, which I'm sure you can understand, particularly as it affects our children. We have now the prospect of Muslim children in our own school districts coming to our own schools with special dietary needs, praying five times a day. We're talking about interrupting of our community and in our classes. We've got a shift in our demographics that's has some unintended consequences in our community. And we need to, like you say, Lauren, look forward to the future, but we need to watch our step. This community is known for being careful in future forward planning.
Pastor Lauren, are you concerned about some of the Christian children in your community becoming Muslims when they see Muslims praying five times a day in school?
I guess I would have to say that, what do I have to say, Reverend Fowler?
let's ask Reverend Fowler.
First of all, I want to commend this pastor, huh?
I said just say no.
Okay, no.
I want to commend this Lutheran pastor, which I've never heard from Lutheran pastors before, is to say we're going to move forward.
Let me answer that more directly and clearly. I'm not concerned. I believe that God works through that God works. We believe as a nation that God is active, and we have to make room for other faiths. And there's opportunities for Muslims to be Christians. And I believe, and I think that Christianity and the Lutheran faith can hold its own. And so I'm not at all threatened. I think it's wonderful.
And what about you, Gary, from the standpoint of the city council and the health of the city of Tranquility, from the standpoint, of the Chamber of Commerce, what is your view?
Well, representing the business community, I want to kind of bring to the attention here that 15% of our population are Muslims, but they pay 22% of the taxes. This is a well-off community. This is a community that has the money to build this mosque and on a prime piece of land. They're going to employ construction folks and builders. It may cause more to move in, and their successful business may make our city more well-off. Also, I think it's pretty well recognized that America is built on immigration. It's built upon diversity. And the greatness of our country and the pride that we have on all of the different parts of our country, the melting pot that has made us a great nation, is something that we want to encourage. And the diversities where our children do get to know people of other faiths and other traditions can help them build bridges and community build that will make Tranquility a long-standing, peaceable community. Mm-hmm. You may gain some short-term avoidance of mixing through this decision, mm-hmm. but you may cause increased division. And we've seen since 9/11 how serious that misunderstanding and that division can be. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a real important time that we increase this opportunity for us to know one another. And I would say before we make any further discussions, I would like to promote the idea that the Chamber at its next meeting a week from now invite the leaders of the Muslim community, the business leaders that are part of our chamber and a part of our community, mm-hmm. to kind of help us understand their position and their, for us to get a sense of how respectable and how strengthening these people already are, and help us kind of remove the fear that we have about this unknown. I think the opportunity for our children to be involved in diversity is too important to miss that chance.
I appreciate so much your concern. for diversity in our community and involving our children. And I want to express appreciation for you wanting to bring into the business community an untaxed half of the city block right in our commercial core. I want to tell you how much that impresses me that the business community would step up to the plate in such a way. I want to point out that the children here are the people we need to be most concerned about, our future. This particular project is right across the street, you know, from our high school and within a half a block of our middle school. The traffic on Main Street already is at 89% of capacity. They're talking about a parking lot with room for 500 to 600 cars, and much of the traffic on Friday during the time our children will be coming out of school. Dealing with the impact of this, I want to express that we have a wonderful neighboring community down the road here. Bleeding Heart has already agreed. The city of Bleeding Heart has got 6 acres on the edge of town, and they are all ready to permit this particular project, and we can very much welcome them to have an untaxed facility in their community. And the Muslims that you point out have a quick drive to the mosque very easily without impacting our children.
Well, I want to bring out this piece of information that questions the facts that you've just presented.
You're not calling me a liar, certainly.
I think you might be misinformed, and I think that the information can help everybody overcome a mistake that could otherwise be made. The concern is that the permit process has already gone forward and has studied these things and comes up with very different conclusions than the ones that you're citing. And I want to point to the city engineer and the projections over the next 10 years that show that we will reach 72% of traffic potential after this is already there. And so we can go further into a discussion about the details of that, but the city engineer and all of the program planning has a completely different conclusion than you've drawn, and they're the ones that study and are responsible for this information, are members of the chamber, and have gone through this permit process in detail already. The other thing that I'm concerned about and wonder about is that developing a task force and delaying this project, I'm wondering if you're suggesting that a similar approach should be used for all other churches that might be built, so that we do have an equitable response and due consideration for the taxable effects of this. I think that if we took a poll of other churches and asked if they would want to have that prevention in terms of their efforts to expand, to add a playground, to put a daycare on their program, if this moratorium is going to be held, we should ask all the churches if they are wanting to have that same limitation on themselves.
Now, of course, we wouldn't be here at Larry King Live if this had already been agreed to by our community.
Right, and I'm afraid that Larry King Live is going to have to discontinue because we're out of time tonight. Stay tuned tomorrow, Bleeding Heart. We'll be here, the Bleeding Heart community. So, thank you very much.
Good word.
Good job.
There you go.
Okay. I'll see all of you tomorrow. I think it was a good exercise, but you can see how sometimes the public encounters are almost the last step, where you really want to have private talks with people as much as possible, and then move more into the public debate as kind of a last straw.
Just because we divided up and postured for our constituencies.
Right.
Everybody was having to look good for their constituents.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. But the basic framework of a civic leader such as the city, the head of the Chamber of Commerce interacting with the city council person, and a moderate religious leader interacting with a not so moderate religious leader, and the Chamber of Commerce head and the moderate pastor figuring out how they're going to approach this politically and, in a sense, almost theologically with this person. That's really what you need to start thinking about that. And at the same time, remember the triangle. And that was based on my our experiences in Jerusalem, thinking, you know, Muslim, Jewish, Christian. It may be different in your community. It may mainly be it may be those three faiths, or it may be others. And so if you can set that system up to where you've got the remember the relay and advocacy, the communication over from, we're seeing this as very aggressive. The permit's taking a long time. We've heard people at city in City Hall saying that they've been told to slow it down, you know. Then they call up, you know, Lauren, or they call up Gary, and they say, we've heard that there's a problem here, and could you try to deal with it? That's probably the most effective way to respond. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much.
The idea is to know your players.